from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in our opening hour of this morning's forum program, yesterday, California Governor Jerry Brown announced that he will send a search and rescue team to Nepal to help with relief efforts after Saturday's devastating earthquake. The 7.8 magnitude quake has claimed the lives of more than 4,000 people and caused thousands of injuries and left many without shelter. And in this hour, we'll get the latest on the rescue operations, which have been hampered by aftershocks and weather. We'll also talk to a leader of the Bay Area Nepalese community about efforts to reach and provide support for loved ones. And we'll let you know how you can help. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. On Saturday, a devastating 7.8 earthquake hit Nepal in a hilly area west of Kathmandu, with reports today of aftershocks across the region. The death toll has risen to over 4,000, with thousands of injuries, and emergency crews reaching some of the rural areas at the epicenter of the quake are now reporting that entire villages have been leveled. The earthquake also was felt in India, China's region of Tibet, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and 61 are thus far reported to have died in India and in a few other neighboring countries, while 18 died in an avalanche, including a local 33-year-old San Francisco resident and Google executive named Dad Friedenberg. In this morning's opening forum hour, we want to update you on the earthquake in Nepal and on what is being done in its wake. And we spoke earlier this morning with Sanjay Karki, who is the county director in Nepal for Mercy Corps, an international development organization. Sanjay Karki, welcome to Forum. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I know we're really talking about a terrible and devastating tragedy here, but please update us on what you
There's just a tremor just now. So
you just felt a tremor this second. The aftershocks are particularly scary, are they not?
So we just felt it now, and it's fine now.
Okay, I'm glad. But I know the aftershocks have been quite severe, even getting up to magnitudes so close to 7. At this point, can you give us a picture of, well, what it's like in Kathmandu, and particularly what kind of aid you're able to give those in more remote areas?
Well, the situation is quite terrifying because people are, not used to this many, aftershocks. Like, we've had more than 70 aftershocks since the last two, three days. There's a lot of, uncertainty. There's a lot of panic among people. You can see, people staying outside, not willing to go inside their houses. So makeshift, tents, tarpaulins and all. So they're, residing outside most of the time. And Mercy Corps, as an humanitarian agency, we've been here since 2005, and we've been trying to do a rapid need assessment here along with the government and other coordination humanitarian bodies. So currently now we're, responding with, basic, household items like blankets, tents, and also water purification tablets in many pocket areas in and around Kathmandu.
Well, it's particularly difficult, as I understand it, getting up into the remote regions.
The army and the armed police force have been mobilized in these areas, and they're getting a lot of information. Road access is going to be difficult. There's a lot of forecast of rain and, thunder, lightning and all. So however, the weather has been nice today. So there's a lot of people are being mobilized by humanitarian aid agencies and the government in these remote areas. So I think this aid will slowly also get into remote areas of Nepal.
What about getting into the Nepal region itself? I mean, how's the airport at this point?
Airport is open, fully today. So there's a lot of rescue helicopters coming in from India, Pakistan, and China and a lot of agencies from U.S. have been sending people here to UN, to other like aid agencies. So it's moving. The airport is open, so that's a relief.
And the hospitals overcrowded, and as I understand,
hospitals are crowded. There's been like blood donation drives going on by various organizations around the city. So there's going to be a need of medicines, mosquito nets, and basic medical accessories.
Vaccines are short, and supplies and resources in general are terribly short. Are they not?
Not at the moment. Vaccines are in full strength, so that should not really be a problem.
What do you see as the major problems now in terms of getting international aid to those who need it?
I think reaching out in remote areas outside Kathmandu is going to be a challenge, and also like coordinating between various humanitarian agencies, because there might be a lot of replication, duplication of assistance going to certain communities and not going to the most needy ones. So that coordination has to be well managed between the aid agencies and also the government and the private sector involved.
Well, we wish you good luck. We hope the aftershocks will stop and that the weather continues to be at least seasonable.
Sure, sure. Thank you.
That was Sanjay Karki, whom I spoke with earlier, who is country director in Nepal for the Mercy Corps, an international development organization. We have a number of other people with us this morning to follow up in analysis and reaction to what occurred in Nepal. Ross Stein's here in studio. He's a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park. And good morning, Ross.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. We also have a number of people with us by phone. Anil Pandey is chair of Motherland Nepal, a Nepalese community group here in the Bay Area. He's also Nepal's official tourism ambassador for San Francisco, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
We also want to welcome Harold Chappell-Howman, who is fire chief with the Menlo Park Fire Protection Division, or district, excuse me. He's formerly also the head of the state and federal urban search and rescue program. And, Chief, it's good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome Elisa Ayers, who is with us by phone this morning, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia from 2010 to 2013. Welcome, Elisa Ayers.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Obviously, we've got a lot of elements we want to cover here. I want to begin, if I may, Anil Pandey, with you, chair of Motherland Nepal, which is a Nepalese community group. Anil Pandey, first of all, there's so much tragedy here, and many people here in the Bay Area and throughout the country are feeling a great deal of heartfelt compassion and sympathy. And I know it must be particularly difficult with so many family and friends and loved ones just trying to connect, just trying to find out how everybody is and who survived.
True. I mean, right now, we just try to figure out where is our loved one, if they're safe or in a nice area, which is, we know by heart is very hard and difficult time, but we still keep looking and, keep searching for our loved ones, and it's not that easy text. It is so hard to find out because there's no electricity, there's no telephone, there's no, Facebook, and no, it's a lot of all those services, are down, and it's very hard, even because the earthquake didn't happen only in the Kathmandu when it comes to Nepal, because it started from, as you said earlier, Tibet, India, Nepal. And Nepal is one of between two huge countries, sandwiched between two countries, India and Tibet and China. So, we are doing all our best. And, just for example, yesterday when I talked to all my, people in Bay Area, most of them, and they said fine. And after 2 hours, we find out one of my close, friend who lives in El Cerrito lost his 5 family members from one house.
It's terribly sad what we're seeing and what we're hearing about. And as you say, the country is in the dark. There have been 70 aftershocks. And for those of you, and there, I guess there are about 6,000 to 8,000 of you here in the Bay Area from Nepal and, Bhutan and Tibet, there's really no place where you can meet. You just have to use social media as best you can.
True. past, I mean, you know, as a chairman of Motherland Nepal, I've been knocking the door from all, I mean, all government, congressmen, I mean, senator, all the level, even local mayor, even the governor, when Jerry Brown became a governor, I thought I was very happy. I mean, I was the one of the happiest person because I thought maybe now he will understand our culture. I mean, he has a lot of experience, Hinduism, Buddhism, he practiced. I thought maybe we'll have some small shelter where for the community, you know, small cultural center, Motherland Nepal has been trying to build one community, I mean, cultural center, Motherland Nepal cultural center, but we were never lucky enough. If we have that today, we all gather there, we all share, we all, you know, cry together, but now we all are in our home, individual, independent. We are all crying, praying for country and people.
Again, Anil Pandey with us by phone, chair of the group Motherland Nepal. They're a Nepalese community group here in the Bay Area. He's also Nepal's official tourism ambassador for San Francisco. And Chief Harold Shabalhoman, who's had a great deal of experience with rescue operations, is with us as well. He's Menlo Park Fire Protection District Chief and formerly head of the State and Federal Urban Search and Rescue Program. And certainly a lot has changed in terms of search and rescue, Chief, I mean, particularly after Mexico City. But it's right now, I mean, one of the biggest challenges is not only getting there, but into the field, I imagine, right?
That's always the biggest problem on a foreign event like this, just because of the amount of logistical support it would take to not only fly them over there, but also to get them to where they're going to be in a place that they could be most useful. And that's, you know, we're talking about 56 personnel and dogs and equipment, thousands of pounds of equipment that would be brought with them.
I think people also have to get a sense of the scope of this. It's really much worse than Katrina. It's as bad in some way. It's similar more to what happened in Haiti or in Thailand, yes?
From what I understand, that is it. And Haiti is a good example because with one single airfield, you know, they very quickly were overwhelmed by resources coming in. And from what I understood over there, at least, that they had to make room for additional aircraft, couldn't fly aircraft out because of fuel. And because of required checks, so that bogged the airport up for a period of time. On the reverse side of that, here in the States, we actually had rescue teams that were in line to go, and were left on the tarmac simply because they switched gears quickly at some point because they realized that the humanitarian and medical problem was much larger than the problem of having people who were found or could be found in collapsed structures. And you know, that's really what they're going to probably have to address here at some point, too, is the window is a narrow window to find people alive in structures. You know, if you go by the numbers, the first day it's in the 80th percentile. The next 24 hours of the second day, it drops down in the 30s. It stays there till about the fourth day. It drops down into the teens. And then by the fifth day, it's at, you know, single digits and dropping. It doesn't mean there's not going to be miracles, but you know, it's a small window.
You're really fighting against time here. I mean, and also serious water problems and no electricity. I mean, that all is formidable too in terms of what you have to do to and to find people beneath the rubble, just to find who survived.
Well, and the key there on that is going to be where do you place them, because you're talking about very sophisticated teams that have a lot of equipment, a lot of capability. They can do, you know, miraculous things, but you wouldn't want to put them, let's say, on, you know, single-family residential structures. You'd want them to be on where there's known to be large numbers of victims that are trapped and potentially could be salvaged. So that's going to be an educational process, I think, for people over there as well.
And if I could go to you, Alyssa Ayers. Alyssa Ayers, again, a senior fellow counsel on foreign relations. There's also real challenges just because of the infrastructure and governance problems in Nepal. I mean, this is a terribly poor country, but it depends on tourism. It's not necessarily exactly rich in resources. Quite the contrary, it's an impoverished country. So we have all that as part of this mix.
Well, that's right. And to add to that, Nepal has had a really difficult political situation for the last 15 years. It has very successfully managed to come out of a decade-long insurgency. That's been positive and good. But the intervening years, really from 2008 forward, I mean, Nepal has had seven prime ministers since then, as it converted itself into a republic instead of a constitutional monarchy. And having that kind of churn in your government makes it much, much harder to put in place, you know, the capacity to mobilize all your different ministries and get them to focus and implement policies. Nepal developed in 2008 a plan for disaster risk reduction focused on earthquakes, but to the best of my understanding, it has not been completely implemented. And so you can sort of see the outcome of that, that the ideas are in place, people have the right intention, but, you know, there is a real capacity issue.
Well, with a disaster of this sort, of this scale, I imagine there must be tremendous challenges for these international agencies. And by the way, I know a number of people are wondering how they can help, and organizations have been vetted like Catholic Relief and Oxfam and World Vision, also CARE and the Red Cross, of course. But just getting in there and working with government officials, we're talking about major impediments, aren't we?
Just the coordination factor that your earlier guest spoke of, I would imagine, would be a substantial barrier. I mean, how do you coordinate and get information out, let people know where they can help, what agencies, what organizations should try to pick up the slack in which areas? There have been additional issues just with the aftershock and the tremors, the airport closure, the reopening. At the moment, India has been taking the lead. Obviously, it is the closest to Nepal, the closest to fly into Kathmandu. India has a very robust capability with its National Disaster Management Agency. It's been flying in relief supplies. China, as you mentioned, is now coming in supporting. But, you know, the Nepal Red Cross, we've seen reports that the hospitals now, the need of patients is vastly exceeding the number of beds that currently exist in Nepali hospitals. So that is obviously going to continue to be a huge challenge in the coming days.
And what about the political considerations with China and India taking preeminent roles here?
Well, I wouldn't be concerned about them taking a leadership role in providing assistance. I think in a time of crisis, whatever assistance can come forward from countries close by should be welcome. But it's certainly the case that India and China have a geopolitical competition for influence. Nepalese refer to their country as being a yam between two boulders, the great boulders of China and India that surround it. I wouldn't begrudge anyone providing a critically needed assistance in an urgent time of humanitarian need, but I think it's definitely the case that both countries would like to see themselves as exercising influence over Nepal.
And again, Alyssa Ayers is Senior Fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia from 2010 to 2013. And Ross Stein is here in studio with us, geophysicist with U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, emeritus now, I believe, yes. Ross, some tough lessons here about poor buildings, and this is a dense population, but let's go right to the heart of this. I mean, in terms of hard lessons of improper built buildings and really not enough open space, those are the two serious problems that we're looking at here, aren't we?
Yeah, this Kathmandu is got many problems. One is massive growth in population. It's now 2 million people. And the city is basically built on a bowl of jello. It's a deep basin of sediments, and that means that no matter where the earthquake is, these bowls get shaken harder. Mexico City is another example. And so despite the fact that the earthquake covers a very broad area, Kathmandu gets hit very hard.
And just a week ago, I believe, there were 50 scientists in Kathmandu talking about not only how vulnerable that city and that region was, but also saying an earthquake was inevitable. I mean, at this point, it almost seems as if there was some prescience there because it was just literally a week ago. And I'm wondering at this point what we can learn to be more prescient here, especially since this rests, as I understand, on two tectonic plates and there's a lot of seismic activity. So there are analogies.
There certainly are. In fact, the size of this earthquake is about the same size as the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco and the 1857 earthquake on the southern San Andreas. So the size of this earthquake is nothing unusual to what the San Andreas can also produce. I would say that while there might be some kind of prescience, no one can predict earthquakes, not in California and not in Nepal. What we know from the long historic record of this collision zone between India and Tibet is that there have been a millennium of great earthquakes along that boundary that contains Kathmandu, earthquakes up to magnitude 9. So from that standpoint, there was no surprise that large earthquakes have occurred and can occur in the future. And the problem is it's just very difficult to get people to act when you can't say it's going to occur at a certain time period. It's always uncertain until the moment it's happened.
And yet every time there's a devastating earthquake like this, we learn more. We learn more geologically, at least that's always been my understanding. And there's been simulations, have there not, about like 7.8 earthquakes on San Andreas and even estimates of a couple thousand people dying, that sort of thing?
That's right. There have been a lot of very thoughtful efforts to try to envision scenarios and how it would affect buildings. The good news is we live in very, very different kind of buildings than people do in Kathmandu and these high mountain villages in Nepal. Because of poverty, because the lack of building regulations and the lack of understanding how to build strong buildings, many, many buildings in this part of the world, like Haiti, are frail, and they come down. We mostly live in wood frame houses in the Bay Area and across California, which are rather rubbery by comparison, tend not to fail on us. And so California experiencing the same earthquake will be very, very different, fortunately, than what's happened in Nepal.
But still a lot of retrofitting needs to be done.
Absolutely. Anybody who lives in a house built before 1977 could strengthen their building for a modest cost and for an enormous savings in their survival. The injury rate drops by a third if you're in a retrofitted home or a home built to the modern code compared to an old one. And there's money to be saved, too, by living in a retrofitted building, because when that earthquake occurs, you'll experience a lot less damage. So we, too, can be more prepared. There's no comparison between the kind of tragedy that befalls Nepal and what would happen in the same earthquake here, but we can do a much better job.
And Ross Stein here with us in studio again is scientist emeritus of the U.S. Geological Survey and consulting professor of geophysics at Stanford, and someone who's given us a whole primer that's been quite helpful in understanding the magnitude of this quake. You're talking about 7.9 being 20 times larger than the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, or about 800 times larger than the 2014 South Napa quake.
Yeah, in the strange math of earthquakes, size really matters. So it's hard for us to believe that an earthquake could be so much larger than what we experienced in the Bay Area. But that's what happens here. And it means, in addition to the strength of shaking, the duration of shaking. So while it shook for several seconds, maybe 5 or 6 seconds at Napa, it shook for 60 seconds. In the Nepal earthquake. And that means the building progressively weakens as it gets thrown from side to side. And that contributes also to the destruction.
I know there are many of you who have thoughts and are reflecting about this disaster, or certainly have questions that you may want to bring to the fore here. And we do welcome your involvement. Like to hear your reactions, like to hear your concerns, and certainly like to hear your questions, whatever they may be. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. And again, you can also find a link to a list of vetted charities on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. But you can call us now at our toll-free number and join the program at 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. You can also join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. And we're talking again about Nepal's 7.8 magnitude earthquake, which has claimed the lives of really over 4,000 people now and left many more without shelter and thousands injured. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the earthquake in Nepal, and it has been a devastating earthquake with roughly around 70 aftershocks and a magnitude of 7.8. And certainly we're talking about it not only in terms of what it means for the future of Nepal, but as a kind of understanding of how it pertains here in California, in earthquake country, as we call it. It was a huge earthquake. Over 4,000 people now have died from what we know, and there have been thousands of injuries, and we're We got an update earlier from Sanjay Karki. I'm also interested in hearing if some of you, our listeners, have been to Nepal. I happen to be at Yosemite this weekend, and strangely enough, I was looking at all the mist there and thinking of Shangri-La and things of that sort. I've never been to Nepal, but you know, I know from many people who have that it's a beautiful country. Many people go there to try to scale Everest, or at least do some scaling up on Everest, as this young man who was a Google executive, who's a San Francisco native, was doing for the third time, and tragically was killed in this really devastating earthquake, as we've been talking about it. You may want to talk also about the geology. Ross Stein with us to help us understand that, geophysicist and scientist emeritus with the U.S. Geological Survey. We also have Avil Pandey with us, who is the chairman of Motherland Nepal, and Harold Chappell-Homan, who is a fire chief, Menlo Park Fire Department, but also formerly head of the State and Federal Urban Search and Rescue Program, and Alyssa Ayers, a senior fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations, who's talking with us about really Nepal's history and its politics. And again, you can join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and you can find a link to a list of vetted charities on our website by, again, going to kqed.org/forum. I was just going to ask Ross Stein, who's here with us in studio, about this. To get a better picture of what we're talking about here, India has been, as Russ puts it, crashing into Tibet in a super slow motion collision that's lasted 40 million years. But that, using your language here, mauled the front end of the collision in the Himalayan foothill thrust fault system. And that sustained huge earthquakes for centuries. Yeah.
That's right. Imagine that you're driving a Cadillac, with an old Cadillac with one of those long hoods, and you come flying into the back of a parked Hummer. So this, imagine this is a very slow motion collision. And basically what's going to happen is the front end of that Cadillac is going to get shoved underneath the much bigger Hummer. It's going to shove the Hummer up, and it's going to start to compress the front end of the car. Now, if you just play this tape extremely slowly, you'll see that the engine is going to be pushed into the front passenger compartment. But what's happened is the people in the back seat don't even yet know that an accident has occurred because it's happening so slowly. This is really what's happening. This is what's causing Tibet to be the roof of the earth. It's being shoved upward in this collision. It's the front end of that Cadillac was being shoved underneath Tibet. And this torn bumper zone is where all these earthquakes occur. So there is no other place like it on earth. It's the greatest site of continental collision we have known.
Let me bring in our callers, and our first caller is joining us from Santa Clara. Pradeep, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael.
Yes, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yes, I had a quick question, a comment for Professor Ross Stein. So I'm originally from Nepal, and I'm currently in Santa Clara, work as an engineer for Intel. So my parents are in Nepal, and it's been a nightmare connecting with them, as one of the callers or one of the guests alluded earlier. So my question was, all these aftershocks. So there have been the main 7.9 earthquake. It's almost been 2.5 days since that occurred. And there has been like continuous aftershocks, 60 or 70 of magnitude, ranging from anywhere from 3 to 6.5 or so. So I was wondering, so the main concern back home is how long will this last? And how worse can it get? And I've been trying to tell him that no one can predict anything, but if there's any scientific data or understanding on aftershocks that can happen, that would be very fantastic, and we could relay that information.
Yeah, Pradeep, thank I appreciate you. The question, and I know many others will. And Ross Stein, can you help us here in terms of how we measure aftershocks or quantify?
Yes, we can. So the property of aftershocks is they get less frequent with time, but no smaller. So if we look at the first week, we're going to see about the same number and the same range of sizes as we look at the next 10 weeks, and after that, the next 100 weeks. So that makes it kind of psychologically tricky, because we do not have aftershocks that get smaller with time. They just get spaced out with time. So if we look at the next week, the probability of another magnitude 6 is about 50-50. If we look at the next month after that, the probability of a 6 is still about 50-50. If we look at the next several years after that, the probability is still about that level. So in general, what people need to understand is that aftershocks will continue, will get space, more spaced out in time, but will not necessarily get smaller.
And Pradeep, I thank you for the call and wish you the best. I know you have friends and family there, and I want to bring another caller on, and that's Dean. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just curious if people out there, we went to Nepal this time last year and had done some touring around, and it's just a beautiful place. We drove from Kathmandu to Pokhara, and we stopped in Gorkha, which from what I understand is where the earthquake is centered, and there's just beautiful temples, and the people are great. And what I'm curious about is we went to Pokhara and then up to the Annapurna base camp from there. And we're just curious how bad, like, the roads and bridges and, their India's main industry is tourism. And we were even thinking about going back in the fall next time. And we're just curious, is it going to take a long time to recover? And for people that are interested in still going back there, is it going to take years to rebuild and make it safe for, tourists to go and, tour up into the mountains?
It's an important question, Dean, and I thank you for it. And Anupandi, as I said earlier, was Nepal's official tourism ambassador for San Francisco. Anupandi, what do you envision? It may be a little bit too early, but, the economy there is so dependent on tourism. You're going to have to get things back in shape to some degree, no?
Absolutely, absolutely right. And by the way, just a few seconds ago, it just hit again in local day time, 9:45, 4.6 hectare scale earthquake just went just like a few minutes ago. So anyway, going back to the question, yes, it is a not really, really developed country. And, we are suffering from so many sector angle. It's going to take quite a long time to, rebuild the country. It's not one part, it's a whole country. And it's going to take quite a long time. But, I would humbly like to request everyone, once I settle down, everything, just visit and see. That will be the good help for the economics and rebuild the country.
And I thank Dean again for his call. We're going to go to another caller. Michael, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, my heartfelt prayers and condolences to everyone who's been affected by this. I live in the Bay Area and was here when the 89 earthquake hit, which was quite a significant experience to go through. And I'm just wondering, since that time, I don't know if any of your panelists can address this, if we are better prepared for earthquakes here in the Bay Area, given that it seems to be so much a part of California law that there's going to be some big one that's going to eventually hit us all. I just thought I'd find out. Thanks.
Well, it's also an important question. And Chief Shabbo-Hellman, can I go to you on this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The answer is yes and no. In terms of the national program that was created out of both Hurricane Andrew and the Loma Prieta earthquake, that's the impetus behind the 28 national teams that were created for urban search and rescue purposes. It was hurricanes, it was earthquakes, and today it's also bombings and other acts of terrorism. But that was one of the key events that made it so the national system could move forward. On the same token, I think there's been a lot of emphasis by local government on community emergency response teams, get ready programs, and then also, as USGS mentioned, a lot more emphasis on building construction codes, improvements there. So I think we are better prepared. However, there's always concern about infrastructure issues. There's an article recently on bridges and sustainability. We saw San Bruno with the gas main explosion and, the weakness, if you will, or the age of our infrastructure when it comes to things we can't see under the ground, like pipes, water, gas. And so there is concern, and there should be concern, and it's a constantly evolving area. But, yes, we are better prepared, but will it be enough? It depends on the size of the magnitude of the next quake and where it occurs.
Well, let me follow that up, Chief Shabbo-Hellman, with an email from a listener who says the natural disaster in Nepal is very similar to what happened in Haiti. Large buildings constructed in ways that do not withstand earthquakes collapsed. Countries without much infrastructure development that lack roadways are difficult to navigate during rescue efforts. I think that pretty much goes without saying, doesn't it?
It does. And I think, to infrastructure, and we saw this in Katrina, a very helpful asset that we have is the United States military. And what I mean by that is in Katrina, once we got air mobility with helicopters, we could be all over the theater of operations. And I think that's going to be a key here in Nepal as well. To get these teams in, it's not just about moving on roads. It's going to be about air operations. So, you know, that's a process here in this country that I think is far in advance compared to other countries. That said, you know, it all takes time. And time is really the biggest enemy of finding people and rescuing them in these types of disasters, regardless of the building construction type. They'll have a greater survivability model here because most of what they have is unreinforced masonry for these buildings that have collapsed. And that's, you know, that's where we're seeing a lot of broken bones, head injuries, and so forth on the victims that live. But, you know, we're talking about entombment, which is a brick-by-brick, layer-by-layer operation that typically doesn't yield too many survivors.
And again, you can find a link to a list of vetted charities and help out that way. It's on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Ross Stein, here's a listener who writes online that this earthquake in Nepal should be a wake-up call to remind all of us living in the Bay Area that this kind of magnitude quake on the Hayward Fault will bring death and destruction to all of the Bay Area. The last time the Hayward Fault had a large magnitude earthquake was in the year 1868. And it has an average cycle of 80 years, which means a very large destructive earthquake like that one in Nepal on the Hayward Fault is way overdue. And all of us in the Bay Area should be ready for such an event when it happens, and it will happen, just a matter of time.
I agree with everything the writer says, except for being way overdue. Earthquakes are very erratic in their timing. So we can never talk about an earthquake as being, or a fault, as 10 months pregnant. The 1868 earthquake, we know from prehistory that there were a number of others, and it is roughly due. So, yes, we should be vigilant and be prepared. And the way to be prepared is to know that when you feel shaking, it's drop, cover, and hold. This is not the time to pull out your cell phone and tweet to your followers. When you feel that earthquake, get under something strong, a desk, a table, and survive. The other thing is, be prepared in terms of having an earthquake emergency kit in your home, in your car. You need to be able to take care of yourself for several days, food, water, warmth, sun protection. And if you want to help others, you want some work gloves and surgical masks so you can deal with concrete dust. So we can all become advocates and effective survivors in this, because we enjoy all the benefits of living in earthquake country. You know, the wine country, the coastal ranges, the bay, all of these things were built for us by the fault. So we enjoy all the fruits of the faults in our everyday life. So we also have to say, okay, the small cost is to be prepared, and we all can be better prepared.
Now let me go back, if I may, Alyssa Ayers, to you. And Alyssa Ayers, again, a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia back in 2010 to 2013. Just how prepared, really, is this government for this kind of disaster? And what are its limitations here, as you see it?
Well, let me say this. It has been known for some years that given the seismic vulnerability of Nepal, that an earthquake would happen, a large-scale earthquake would happen. And the government has been trying to put in place a disaster risk reduction mechanisms to try to, of course, limit the kind of damage that would happen. As I mentioned, they developed a disaster risk reduction strategy in 2008. The international community worked very closely and continues to work closely with the government of Nepal on disaster risk reduction, centered through the UN Development Program, which has been the kind of main partner for the government. The United States made disaster risk reduction a big piece of our diplomacy with Nepal. Same is the case for the EU countries, India as well. How prepared is the government? I think that they had been more prepared than if this attention to the threat of an earthquake hadn't been in place. But again, as you heard from some of the other panelists this morning, just the sort of issues of infrastructure already in place, those kinds of limitations, the massive urbanization that creates a density of population and density of housing that is not seismic resistant. I mean, all these kind of factors are very difficult to undo once they're in place.
And again, you are welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go to another caller, and that's you, Susan, and thank you for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much. I run Resurge International, which is a 47-year-old reconstructive surgical organization that works in developing countries and performs surgeries and trains local teams to do those surgeries. Our largest program is in Nepal. I've been there many times, and we have a 50-member Nepali team right there right now dealing with the trauma cases and the reconstructive cases. I will just underscore what a couple of others have said, maybe slightly different take. Just as in Haiti, what caused the ground to shake was an earthquake. What caused the extent of the devastation was largely poverty, global poverty. And I felt with Haiti that that message never really got across to the American public. I hope it does this time, because that's something we need to address on a more continuing basis.
Well, we thank you for that. I appreciate hearing from you this morning. I'm going to go to some of your emails. John wants to know if anybody on the panel knows anything about the status of the airport at Lukla. All of the trekkers in the Everest area have to fly out through Lukla, and I have friends currently in Namche Bazaar. Can you help us there, Anil Pandey?
Yeah, this is kind of it's pretty tough, and it's not only Namche, because there was so many other. In a small district, is all wipe up, because Nepal goes by district and zone. We have a 14 district and 75 zones. So there are some zones, there's a 200, 300 house. All that entire village, it's done. Nothing there left.
Let me go to another email here. Bob wants to know, would you ask the geologist, Ross Stein, who's here in studio, about the very large area affected? The epicenter between Pokhara and Kathmandu was a long ways from Everest region. Does the brittleness of the Himalayas contribute to the force and area of the earthquake?
That's an interesting question. So for an earthquake of this size, the area of aftershocks and the area of strong shaking is reasonable and expected. Now, Everest is farther, though, away. There was actually an aftershock on the other side of Everest from this event. So these are some very remote aftershocks and effects. I suspect that the situation in Everest is compounded by the fact that there are very, very steep slopes, and it's unstable. It's always unstable, ice and snow. And so it doesn't take much shaking to trigger an avalanche on very, very steep material. And in fact, a lot of these villages are probably in landslide-prone areas, and I suspect we will soon learn that landslides, not just snow and ice avalanches, will have contributed a lot to the fatalities, as they did in the Wenchan earthquake in China in 2008.
Those villages are routinely affected by landslides.
That's right. Yeah. It doesn't even take an earthquake, often just very strong rainfall.
Let me bring another caller in. Robin, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the Oakland CORE program, which is a series of seminars and classes for neighborhoods to learn how to be ready as a neighborhood. I think the emergency services are going to be absolutely overwhelmed kind of within the first few minutes of a major disaster here, and the more neighborhoods are capable of supporting each other, the better off we'll be individually, but also the easier it will be for the emergency services to focus on the areas that don't have the level of support that they need. So it's all free, put on by the Oakland Fire Department. All the trainers are amazing. They've been at, Katrina and Haiti and 9/11, and they're just they're amazing programs, and I just really encourage people to check it out.
We thank you for that call. Appreciate hearing from you, Robin. And there are, there's 29 districts that have already been designated as crisis zones. So the government is acting, and acting with some dispatch, at least one can assume.
Absolutely. Of course it is. I just think that everybody will look to be mobilizing as much assistance and support as they can internationally to help shore up where there just isn't enough capacity to deal with the size of this tragedy. Again, the medical facilities, they're exceeding the number of beds they have. They need supplies. They'll need water filters, the ability to provide clean water for people. I know a threat of cholera is one concern now for people who are abandoned, you know, not able to stay in their homes anymore and sort of sleeping out on the streets.
Well, let me go to an email here. We're getting a lot of these kind of emails, Ross Stein. Can you recommend maybe a few things that we need to make sure that we're prepared for earthquake here in Bay Area?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, walk around your house and make sure that you don't have glassware in that will fly out of your kitchen in an earthquake. So in the middle of the night when you go into your kitchen, you're not walking on ground glass. Look and make sure cabinets and things like that that are heavy, big television screens are secured so that your house itself doesn't become a threat to you. Then think about how old your house is and how well built it is. A structural engineer can look at it for you. Contractors or retrofitters can evaluate it. Often it's very inexpensive to make your house much stronger. Another thing is you should have an emergency kit with food and water and walking shoes and a jacket and a sun hat and work gloves in your car, on your body, you know, in your home, so that you can take care of yourself. So you become a hero for your neighbor and not a victim to your neighbor. So these are all things we can do. Beyond that, have a communication plan with your family so you're able to get in touch with them from several different ways so you know they're okay after an earthquake. So thinking ahead and making sure that your house is as strong as it can be are the things that we all should be doing.
And again, Ross Stein is a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, emeritus, and also a professor at Stanford. We have Oakland-based travel writer Jeff Greenwald, who's the author of Shopping for Buddhas, An Adventure in Nepal, formerly lived in Nepal. Jeff, good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, glad to have you. What are you hearing from
your there's a whole community of people in Nepal who have a shared website, and they've been exchanging news, and it's kind of miraculous that almost all of the people I know, and it's a fairly large community there, are all okay, and they've already stepped out to help each other. Everyone's clearly in a state of shock. It's really just you know, a day or two after the event, and people are just sort of coming out of their rabbit holes and going, everything's changed. You know, the place that's been our iconic home for so many years that we're so invested in is really compromised. That, like everyone else who's been on your show, I'm just waiting, just with kind of dread, for reports from the parts of Nepal that just aren't being served, where there's very little capacity out in the Gorkha area on some of the other trekking routes, like Langtang, the reports of areas that are just devastated. And the comparisons with Haiti, you know, can be made, but of course Nepal's a landlocked country. And with the roads so damaged and the airport so compromised, it's just going to be very hard to get supplies in. One thing I want to add to the person who's just on talking, Mr. Stein, with the earthquake preparedness, is that I actually was on the ground with Mercy Corps in Sri Lanka after the tsunami. And the one thing that's the easiest and that everyone in the Bay Area should really do, most of the injuries that we treated after the tsunami were foot injuries due to people walking without shoes. Mm. Have a pair of sturdy shoes near your bed. You know, it doesn't matter. If there's an earthquake, there's going to be broken glass. There's going to be broken objects. You need to be able to get from point A to point B without shredding your feet. And that's one of the most important things, you know, I think that can be offered. You know, Michael, there's so many emotions and so much incredible sadness in everyone's hearts right now, and it's a feeling of helplessness too, because there's so little we can do except send money and pray it's used wisely. And my sense is that, you know, the further you can get from having the money go through the Nepali government, the more chance of it helping people directly. So organizations like Mercy Corps, and I know you had them on earlier, that already have great capacity there and are operating with a very small overhead, you know, are really great places to go. for those in the Bay Area who are, you know, very involved with the Buddhist community. The Tibetan Buddhist Associations have set up relief organizations, too. And other than that, I mean, I hardly know what to say unless there's a specific question I can help answer.
Well, you've said a great deal. I mean, you've given us a good picture and some important points, and I'm grateful for that. And again, Jeff Greenwald is the author of Shopping for Buddhas, An Adventure in Nepal. He formerly lived in Nepal. He's now here in Oakland. It also prompts me to go back to Chief Shep Elholman, who, again, was formerly head of the State and Federal Urban Search and Rescue Committee and is still with that organization. And yesterday, I said this earlier, Chief, Governor Brown here in California announced that he's going to send a search and rescue team to Nepal to help with the rescue efforts. What do you foresee them being able to do or to contribute to rescue?
Well, that's actually one of the two national teams. So it's
you mean the two out of Fairfax, Virginia, and L.A., I believe.
No, there's one out of Fairfax County, Virginia, Virginia 1, and then there's Task Force 2 for California because there's eight teams in California. Yeah. We're one of them.
Yeah.
The Task Force 2 L.A. County is both a state and federal team.
Well, how much help can they provide? What can they do, really? What do you?
Well, they're scheduled to be there Tuesday evening, and to the earlier point that I made, I mean, again, yeah, they'll be able to give help and they'll be able to get great things done, but again, time's running out on the survivability clock, so it's going to be more difficult the further along it takes for getting them into the country. The good news is you mentioned it earlier, which is there's different agencies and teams that are there from, you know, closer proximity from China, for example, from Europe and so forth that, you know, we're closer and have gotten into country already.
Oh, we will continue to monitor, and I want to thank all our guests. Harold Chapel Holman, again, is fire chief of the Menlo Park Fire Protection District. Anil Pandey joined us, chair of Motherland Nepal. And we also had Alyssa Ayers with us, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. And Ross Stein here in studio, geophysicist emeritus with U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park. Also spoke earlier with Sanjay Karki from the Mercy Corps. We wish the people, obviously, in Nepal good fortune and hope that they will manage to bounce back and show the kind of resilience that they have shown through the years. And again, you can help and find out how you can help by going to our website. We vetted these organizations that actually are providing help. And Forums produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.